Welcome to Fox Sports On the Road. I'm your host, Michael Cohen. Well, basketball season is definitely upon us. I know it's hard to realize that sometimes, especially with the Yankees in the midst of a playoff chase. And all of a sudden, we got the Jets and Giants playing good football. What decade is it? Both playing good football at the same time. But yes, basketball is here. And Rutgers is about to begin their men's and women's season. We cannot wait to bring those to you, of course, here on Fox Sports New Jersey. But yes, even the NBA, as well as we know, is getting started. They're getting started this week in the NBA. Knicks, Nets, they're getting started this week. And I emphasize the word home because we have a special guest here today to talk about the, well, nomadic lifestyle of the Brooklyn Nets, or formerly the New Jersey Nets. The book is called A History of the Nets from Teaneck to Brooklyn, and its author is Rick Laughlin. You can find this book really everywhere. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at Barnes & Noble, Walmart, anywhere books are sold. Basically, you can find this book. It's a really well put together. Rick, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy to talk about that nomadic history of the Nets. I know it's been a joy to write, and certainly I've had so many interviews, and we can discuss more at length, but going back to the start of the franchise in 1967, really the only constant in the history of the Nets franchise has been their official scorekeeper, who was there for 55-plus years. Everything other than that was a wild, nomadic, chaotic journey for this franchise.
You know, before we even get into talking about the Nets, it just seems that's the case when it comes to the professional sports in New Jersey, right? I mean, we have the Jets and the Giants, who are both, you know, named after New York, started in New York, now play in New Jersey. The Devils are, of course, right now the only team of the major sports that has still used the moniker New Jersey. The Nets now, of course, now in Brooklyn. So it's a nice way to connect to those fans who may not remember the New Jersey Nets, or at least the generation that only knows them as the Brooklyn Nets, to kind of reconnect to that past.
Exactly. In my childhood, I grew up going to Continental Airlines Arena, going to the Meadowlands, knowing them only as the New Jersey Nets. And really, my inspiration for the book was looking up in the rafters and seeing all these ABA Stars and Stripes jersey and the Bill Melchionis and Julius Irvings, of course, and Super John Williamson, and seeing no connection to the team's history in Long Island. And that was even more evident to me when they went from New Jersey to Brooklyn those last couple of years, the interim move to Newark, where it was basically just a pit stop. It was going to be impossible to draw, you know, season ticket holders, certainly, or even fans to the arena for a team that had one foot in the door in New Jersey, one foot out. And again, this is something that's not specific to the Nets. Like you mentioned, teams can't wait to get New York on their jerseys and for the marketability and forget about New Jersey, of course. But it is part of the team's history. So I felt like it was important to cover those New Jersey years and prior to that, the Long Island years, too.
Let's talk a little bit about yourself. How did you get into sports? I mean, did you play sports? Is it something that your parents just kind of got you into?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I grew up playing at the high school level and then some collegiate sports and really enjoyed it thoroughly and realized pretty quickly, I mean, to become a professional athlete in any sport is such a difficult journey, obviously, right? So I looked at the more pragmatic approach of, do I like being around sports? Do I like sports writing, broadcasting? So I started writing for my school newspaper, and, you know, there was a radio station there as well, so I did some radio appearances, and then, of course, the earlier sister station, or I guess you would call it the earlier iteration of Fox Sports New Jersey. I did some work there and some other, different outlets. And I've just always had a passion specifically for basketball and football and baseball. And the Nets, like I said, of the sports that I played, basketball is really my favorite. So I had a special connection with the Nets. And, you know, the more research I did out there, it's really kind of disappointing of how little information there is about, and scarcity of information about Nets history. And I even try to interact and engage the Nets PR team to say, you know, can we get some alumni in, even with this book specifically?
Right.
And they were not very receptive to it. So, you know, I turned to my own means to be able to do that. So I guess the long-winded way of answering your question, Michael, is that this is the next best thing to being on the court and playing for the Nets was kind of reliving and writing the history about the team.
I think that's kind of how we all feel, right? When it comes to the sports media industry, if we can't play it, you talk it. That's the attitude we have. So
less travel, and you get into less trouble that way. So.
Exactly. Unless you're tweeting, that's another journey in and of itself. Now, you brought up a very interesting point, saying that the Nets weren't really receptive, or it was really hard to find history of the team. I it's mind-boggling. I mean, you think about the players that have come through, like Julius Erving and Jason Kidd and Kenyon Martin, and it was hard to find information. Could you just talk about more about that, why it was so hard?
Yeah, I mean, so basically, upon the move to Brooklyn in 2012, the Nets kind of branded as they were starting a new franchise. They would put Brooklyn Nets established 2012. They took, of course, New Jersey off any uniforms. They really didn't even reference the Nets. To this day, they finally started to have the ABA Stars and Stripes jersey, and they've tried to bring back some of that Nets branding and the nostalgia from the ABA days, but that is few and far between. They felt like, and I spoke to Irina Pavlova, who was she worked as a marketing executive under Mikhail Prokhorov, and she basically said that was concerted effort on the part of her and Brett Yomark at the time, who was the CEO and marketing executive, to push the Brooklyn brand, that they really, and it was such a flawed marketing strategy, they wanted to turn all Brooklynites into Nets fans. And as every Brooklynite could tell you that's rooted for the Knicks since God knows when, that's going to be a difficult thing. You're not going to be able to convert. Sports fans are loyal. You're not going to be able to overnight convert just because a team's moving to that borough to become Nets fans. So it was a flawed marketing strategy to begin with. And not only that, but they alienated their fan base in New Jersey. They made it impossible. Not only is it impossible to get to Brooklyn, the scarcity of parking, but even in Long Island too. So the Nets were really struggling. And I would argue to this day to get a strong ticket season ticket holder base, because in Brooklyn, they haven't exactly been selling out every game. And you had all the off-the-court drama with Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant and what's supposed to be a championship-type season. You know, I always wonder, and everyone asks me, well, what's the next chapter of Nets history? I don't know where the team's going to be in 5 or 10 years. They could move back to Long Island. They could be back in New Jersey. They could be in Seattle. I really can't tell you that this model that they've now established in Brooklyn is going to be sustainable for the next 5, 10-plus years.
We'll get into more of that as far as, you know, talking about the future of the franchise in a minute. But one thing I see is that your passion for the subject, and I was wondering, you know, what would be your inspiration for writing this book? And I think it's just and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like it's the mystery of this franchise, this franchise that for years didn't have a really great hit track record until really the beginning of the 2000s, turn of the century. Was that really your inspiration? Was it just kind of, you know, being a kid growing up and watching the Jason Kidd era? What was really inspiring you to do this book and to do this research?
Yeah, I think it was almost the curiosity factor. Not that the Nets were trying to bury their history, but it felt like that in a way. And I felt like I was almost like an investigative reporter, like what exactly went on here? And I have to put the pieces of the puzzle together and talk to the people that were involved with the team. And I talked about this at the start, but Herb Turetsky, who was the official scorekeeper, it was almost serendipitous how he actually became. It was the first year they're playing at the Teaneck Armory in New Jersey. They're not even the New Jersey Nets, the New Jersey Americans. And he basically is doing a favor for the head coach of the Nets, which is Max Zavlosky, and keeping score that game. And he tells a story where he sits down at that scorer's table in 1967 in October, and he's their official scorekeeper until April of 2021. And of course, he's since passed on, but he gave some tremendous interviews, like insights to prior to when I was even born, able to watch the Nets going back into the late 60s and throughout the 70s and early 80s. And for me, it's just such an interesting story that I felt like was never told and was almost buried in team lore, because there weren't many. If you're a Nets fan, you've lived through the 30-plus years I have, and for those Nets fans that precede me 50-plus years, there have been a lot more embarrassing and terrible moments in Nets history than there have been proud ones. But it's all part of kind of the team and franchise's story that ultimately one day you would hope as a Nets fan maybe culminate in a championship. That looks lesser likely than it has, you know, when Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving first got here. But, you know, I really wanted the fans that were only knew the Nets as Brooklyn Nets to understand the full history of this team, because, you know, they became fans of Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. They may not even know the Nets played in Long Island or even played in New Jersey. And I just felt like it was my mission to kind of put the story out there, and whether people read it or not, that's the hope, I guess.
Right? That's the prerogative, and of course, we that's why we have you on the air to talk about this book. So we're going to take a quick break here again with Rick Laughlin. He is the author of A History of the Nets, From Teaneck to Brooklyn. It is being put out by Arcadia Publishing, I believe that's correct.
History Press and Arcadia.
History Press and Arcadia. We will be taking a quick break. We're back right after this. And welcome back, folks, here to Fox Sports On the Road. I'm your host, Michael Cohen, and we are again joined by Rick Laughlin, author of A History of the Nets, From Teaneck to Brooklyn, put out by History Press and Arcadia Publishing. And, Rick, you know, we were just talking about Nets history here and the motivation to write the book. What were some of the more interesting things that you discovered in doing this research and putting this book together?
Well, one of the things was going back, this would have been in 1996 when Ray Chambers was basically interested in buying the Nets from the Secaucus Seven. There was a lot of dysfunction because the Nets had seven different owners. I spoke to Michael Rowe, who was the team president with the New Jersey Nets starting in 1995. And prior to that, he was actually the president of the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority. He tells a story about just basically trying to get seven, and there was actually eight owners, one of them was silent, on the same page of trying to sell the team. And there was basically a phone call. This is one of the fascinating tidbits that came out of this book and was never before told story, was basically when the Knicks were looking to complete a majority sale to Cablevision, they needed the approval of all the rest of the NBA teams in order for that sale to go through. So all of a sudden, the late commissioner, NBA commissioner David Stern, called Michael Rowe, who was the team president of the Nets, and said, Michael, the Knicks need something from you. What are you going to ask them for? Mm-hmm. And Michael kind of scratched his head, said, I'm not sure. And he said, Michael, you're going to ask them for the rights to move anywhere outside of New Jersey within the New York metropolitan area. Because just to give you some background, when the Nets were trying to establish, they weren't even the Nets, the New Jersey Americans trying to establish as a franchise, the Knicks were either fining them or stymieing them at every attempt to try to get into New York. Mm. And even upon when they moved to Long Island and, of course, were merged into the NBA, they had to pay an expansion fee to the NBA, and they also had to pay a territorial rights fee to the Knicks. And then they moved back to New Jersey, and they had to pay a territorial rights fee for moving back to New Jersey. So every step of the way, the Knicks had really created so many blockades for the Nets. And this was a groundbreaking moment because now the Nets could kind of turn the tables and move anywhere within the metropolitan area. So that opened when the Nets, that's a Caucus 7 as they were, mm-hmm. were basically looking for bidders to buy the team. That all of a sudden opened Pandora's box because now the Nets, there was a scenario where the Nets were going to share MSG with the Knicks and try to make a scenario where that would work. There was an offer on the table from Charles Wong, the owner of the Islanders, where they were going to move back to Long Island mm-hmm. and build an arena, a new arena for the Nets to play at. And then ultimately, of course, the team sells to a group that, you know, has them in turn move to Brooklyn. Bruce Ratner, we know the whole situation where 8 years in the making, they stop in Newark, and then they end up in Brooklyn. But at that time, the ownership, the Secaucus Seven, wanted to keep the team in New Jersey. And they ultimately weren't able to do that. They sold it to Ray Chambers, who wanted to keep the team in New Jersey, but just because of financial constraints was unable to. He sold it to Ratner, who ultimately moved it to Brooklyn. So it's just another piece of nomadic Nets history, that one phone call from David Stern, which was an enlightening phone call from Michael Rowe to say, you can lift that territorial restrictions, now is the reason why the Nets are in Brooklyn, because they would not have been able to do that had David Stern not called Michael Rowe and told him that.
Even if he had done that, do you think there was a way to keep the team in New Jersey? Because obviously the Continental Airlines Arena, or now is the Izod Center, it was not a great location for basketball. Obviously a lot of great memories there, you know, late 90s and early 2000s, but it was not a great location. It's, you know, of course now all surrounded by the, you know, Xanadu, and of course now the new MetLife Stadium at right now. But I thought Newark was the perfect location for the Nets, or even moving down here to Central Jersey to come, you know, play basketball here. Perfect location for the Nets because they are the New Jersey Nets. And of course, this is a big basketball area. I mean, Rutgers, of course, is big. And, you know, you go up into Newark and you got NJIT and Rutgers, Newark. You know, there's a lot of passion for the game. I thought it would have been a great location for the Nets to stay in New Jersey. Why didn't they want to stay here?
And I always wonder about that, because if the Meadowlands as it's constructed now was what it was now back then, remember, you know, what you said with Xanadu and that whole project that just sat like an eyesore, never came together. Now it's an entertainment epicenter. It has mass transit, of course, just for, you know, Jets and Giants games. If that was in place back when the Nets were at the Meadowlands, that could have been a sustainable product. Or as you mentioned, I think Newark would have been a better option. One of the reasons, though, that really they weren't able to sustain in New Jersey was just, you know, look at the ease of transportation of fans getting to and from the games. I mean, even those back-to-back finals years in 2002, 2003 – some of those weren't even home sellouts, and there were decisive games that could have been championship aspirations for the Nets, and it just never panned out. So I think ultimately, you know, one of the other funny stories is Michael Rowe and also Eric Spoelstra's father, John Spoelstra, actually he preceded Michael Rowe as a team president. He came up with all sorts of creative marketing promotions. Like, he at one point went to the town of East Rutherford and tried to get them to change their name to Nike, so that the town would get, of course, a lump sum of money, and so would the Nets. And then every time you reference East Rutherford, you have to call it Nike, New Jersey. He also was involved. I mean, it's just really crazy stuff. And there was also a proposed name change, because they were trying – this was around the time, this is in the mid to late 90s, when the Toronto Raptors were coming. They had the cartoon Raptor, and it
with
was
the sneakers,
you know,
and everything
sneakers
else.
And it was like fun for a new age kind of cartoonish character. So they tried to do a proposed name change to the New Jersey Swamp Dragons. So the board, they voted on it. They had the seven owners, one was silent, so eight owners vote on it, and ultimately they got a political pushback from Christy Whitman. David Stern at the time, the league commissioner, said this is the dumbest idea he ever came up with. So every team voted in favor of that name change. So the Nets were literally one vote away from being the New Jersey Swamp Dragons, and the only team to vote against it was themselves, the Nets, because they couldn't get all on the same page to make a name change from the Nets to the Swamp Dragons. I think in retrospect, that worked out well. Maybe the Nets, you know, should have kept that for continuity, the name Nets, but it just shows some of the dysfunction, the disagreement, and not being able to get on the same page, even something as simple as a name change. So they got a lot of political pushback, and the Devils wanted to ultimately move to Hoboken.
Right.
And Christy Whitman said, we need a one arena solution. We can't have the Devils wanting to move to Hoboken and Ray Chambers wanting to move the Nets to Newark. It's just not going to work. And by the time the Devils opted out of their lease at the Meadowlands, they ultimately forged the path to Newark, and the Nets joined them. But you already had Bruce Ratner in the picture that had bigger visions of being part of his real estate development program to move the team to Brooklyn. So it's just a roundabout, crazy way, and you have different owners with different agendas. And Bruce Ratner, thanks to Mikhail Prokhorov's deep pockets, they were able to overcome a lot of obstacles on the way to Brooklyn.
And as you mentioned, the league commissioner also giving the okay to say, hell, you know what? You don't need to have that monopoly on New York for the Knicks. And he lifted that, and that's what really spurred this on, as you said.
And all my secondhand accounts, too, said David Stern hated everything about the Meadowlands. He couldn't take the fact that it was a half-filled arena. He hated getting there. He hated everything about it. So he was probably the happiest of anybody, which is why he made the call to Michael Rowe to say, get out of New Jersey.
Now, you mentioned Herb was a big source for you in researching this book. Any other big sources, people that you may have been able to get in contact with, help you with this book?
Sure. I mean, I had, again, so Kenny Anderson gives some interesting tidbits about those New Jersey Nets with Drazen Petrovic and what the tragic passing of him and that tragic car accident on the Autobahn was the beginning of the end. He talks about how he thinks that core of Kenny Anderson, Derek Coleman, and Drazen Petrovic, and now you're talking like early to mid-90s, the Michael Jordan is in the Eastern Conference, you have the Knicks in their heyday. Mm. He thinks despite that those New Jersey Nets teams, that they've continued on the track they were, and of course they couldn't really get out of the first round, he thinks that they could have won the East one of those days. And again, who's to say not? And Drazen Petrovic still to this day has an incredible legacy, not only, you know, here in New Jersey or domestically in the U.S., but overseas. He's just a revered name. Even Luka Doncic, all the great European-born players watch his play and think about those glory days that he had with the Nets. And that was a special treat for me to talk to Kenny Anderson to bring me into those early 90s teams. And I would say some of the marketing side with Arena Pavlova talks about there was even a proposed name change. They were going to maybe become the Brooklyn Knights upon moving to Brooklyn and get rid of Nets. And they thought of more continuity and said, you know what, there's so much history in the Nets, we have to keep the Nets name, which in retrospect was obviously the right thing to do, because you're not only were they getting rid of New Jersey history, all of a sudden they're going to get rid of Nets history, so it would have been like the start of an entirely new franchise. So at least they kept that piece of things together. So those are two of the more interesting, and I guess one more I have was Bobby Marks, who was assistant GM with the Nets. He talks about during their record-setting 12-70 campaign, that would have been the 2009-2010 season, they had a voodoo expert come in because the team was struggling so badly for wins. They were on pace to set the all-time loss record. And they had a voodoo expert come in with pins and start putting pins into himself and into dolls to show that if I don't feel pain, you can't feel pain, and you're going through a difficult time, but you'll get through it. And Bobby Marks like gave me some remarks about, man, maybe I should consider a career change. This is a very crazy scenario I'm in with voodoo experts and the team can't win. So he's seen the good, the bad, and the ugly being with the New Jersey Nets and Brooklyn Nets.
What can the Nets do now to try to reconnect with these Jersey roots? Because it's still part of their DNA. I mean, obviously, Kyrie Irving being a Jersey kid, you know, being from Orange. What can the Nets do now, in spite of all the craziness that's going on right now with this guy wants to get traded, KD wants to get traded, Kyrie's not happy, you know, rumors about Steve Nash. What can they do really just kind of focus in?
I think ultimately, and you've been one that's actually proposed this, is maybe have, whether it's a preseason game or some kind of, they do an open practice in the park event every year, that maybe that rotates among the different boroughs, and maybe it goes into New Jersey and it's in Newark, or a preseason game of potential. I think that would just really bring in, and now that you have these marketable stars in Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant, maybe that will entice people from New Jersey to make the trek into Brooklyn, and the headaches of the traffic and the scarcity of parking. I think that ultimately, you know, they alienated a lot of fans in New Jersey, and then trying to root for this team, I'll be honest, you know, I still do watch and root for the Nets.
Right.
And the way things were, the way the players conducted themselves last year, all the dysfunction, the locker room turmoil, it made it very difficult for them to be not only likable players, but players that you want to root for when you knew they weren't really giving 100%. You have, you know, James Harden in one door, out the other. You have now even Ben Simmons, who basically pulled the same stunt on the Philadelphia 76ers landing with the Nets. So I would say when the Nets were the most likable was when they were a likable underdog, with Jason Kidd, of course, making the finals. And even some of those years before they got KD and Kevin Durant, they were just a hard-nosed team, a young, exciting players that were no ego. I think all these guys just have to check their ego at the door, throw these championship aspirations out the window for now, and just let the play on the court speak for itself, and basically let the chips land where they may. And I think at the end of the day, they have enough talent to be a championship team. They just have to put their ego aside and let the personalities mesh.
Yeah, I remember it was a couple of years ago when KD was hurt. They were playing good basketball, and you had all these young players kind of showing off. And then when, of course, KD gets healthy, then they start trading pieces off for Harden, and it's just kind of gone haywire since, losing to Milwaukee in the playoffs, and then, of course, getting ousted just this past spring in the playoffs. So it's been frustrating from the Nets standpoint, right?
Yeah, and that's not even a Nets specific problem. It's the landscape of the NBA now. It's such, yeah. We're in the NBA player empowerment era. So basically, any of these star players can dictate any trade they want to any destination and basically hold a team hostage. And that's something I think in a bigger picture of the NBA, if there's a lockout looming, they have to renegotiate how much power they're actually going to give to the players to be able to dictate not only free agency, but in this case with Kevin Durant, the entire NBA was waiting to see what happened with him before they made any move. So it really slowed down all free agency movement and all moves that were going to be made. And I don't think that's a good thing for the league. I know that obviously, the younger kids and even adults will buy the Kevin Durant jerseys, and they come to see them. And maybe they come more to see the player on the back than on the team on the front. But at the same time, you have to have some kind of loyalty or incentive in these contracts where they can't just, at the drop of a hat, say, I'm out of here.
What was your favorite Nets memory?
Oh, boy. There's a few of them. I would say, you know, and this is a really dysfunctional era, but I would say, yeah, there were a lot of them. But I would say during the 2009-2010 season, I happened to attend four home games, and the Nets won all four games. So I said to myself, boy, that was a season where they won 12 games and lost 70. Maybe I should have gotten season tickets, because maybe they would have won all 41 home games and they could have, you know, made the playoffs. No, so that was fun. I mean, it was such a bittersweet thing, because it was literally their last game at the Meadowlands was like just getting shoved out the door. And, you know, the New Jersey just couldn't wait to get rid of them, and the Nets couldn't wait to get out of Brooklyn, because it was just such a disappointing season.
Yeah.
So there was kind of a bittersweet moment to be at four wins during such a catastrophic year. And then also covering the team when their first big three that they put together with Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and then Jason Terry at the time, and mm-hmm. Darren Williams and Joe Johnson. But that, I covered that media day, and there was so much excitement and buzz around that team. We, of course, know how all that ended. And they opened their home opener against Miami, which was, you know, LeBron James and Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade, and they won that game. And it was like, and they actually beat Miami four times in that regular season. So you thought that, wow, Billy King is an absolute genius, and this is all going to come together. And
Brooklyn's big three is going to beat the Miami big three in the final, yep. Conference finals.
And yeah. Then they lose in five games in the semifinals of that, yeah. In that playoff year. So there was so much hoopla and excitement around that team, the 2013-2014 Nets. And then bringing Jason Kidd back, which I thought was a brilliant move from a marketing PR standpoint, to bring him back as head coach. And as we know, he was only there for 1 year, and everything fell apart, and Paul Pierce left, and that was the beginning of the end. But those were exciting times from a media perspective, covering all the excitement and the anticipation of what should have been a championship run.
I'm going to share you one of mine. And this was as a fan. This was, of course, this going back to the Jason Kidd era when he was a player. And it was during the conference finals. I think it was 03. It was against Detroit. Game 3, that place. And this was the Izod Center. I have never heard that state. And I've been there a couple of times. It was like, yeah, and it was kind of like a smattering of like cheers here and there.
Sure.
But that place was rocking that night. It was game 3. Nets won that game. I don't remember what the score was, but they took care of Detroit. It was on their way to sweep in Detroit and on their way to the finals. A finals that I thought, you know, they hung with San Antonio so close, I thought they probably could have won that series later on. But that was really the height, I thought, of the Nets in New Jersey, because the Knicks were kind of on this downward slope after, you know, getting to the finals in 99. And now it was the Nets, you know, kind of taking over the area at that time.
And that was the other interesting interview I had with Lawrence Frank. He talks about the Nets acquired Jason Kidd, and it was right after September 11, 2001. Lawrence Frank talks about he was one of the first to actually be on a plane once they started plane travel again. And he went to get Jason Kidd. They were working out. They were playing basketball drills during the day, tennis at night, lifting in between. And he talks about Jason Kidd's not only the work ethic, but the idea that the first practice that he ever held with, and he was the assistant coach, Byron Scott was the head coach, Jason Kidd was diving on loose balls, setting like an early tone for the team. And he just was such a quiet leader, led by example. And it just, he got the most out of all his teammates. And again, he's had some off the court struggles that have been well documented. Yeah. But as far as an on the court leader, Lawrence Frank said they were second to none. And ultimately, those Cinderella teams with the Nets, you know, they weren't able to close the deal. Kenyon Martin, of course, he had the flu midway through that NBA Finals run in 2003 when they lost to San Antonio. And they ran into two dynasties. They ran into a Kobe Bryant.
Lakers.
Shaquille O'Neal-led dynasty and Tim Duncan and David Robinson. And you had the emergence of Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili. So, ultimately, again, who knows if the Nets come out victorious in the 2003 NBA Finals, if they land in Brooklyn. There's so many different caveats and so many different roads that could have kept the Nets in New Jersey, maybe at a different venue, and it just wasn't meant to be. But like I said, like we talked about at the start, I'm not ruling out from what I know from Nets history, it's nomadic and it's not linear, so they could end up back in New Jersey or Long Island very, very easily.
Very easily. Again, we're here with Rick Laughlin, author of A History of the Nets from Teaneck to Brooklyn. Before we wrap things up, Rick, again, tell me what you said you covered the team. Tell me more about your journalism work, and then just talk me more about where people can find this book.
Sure. So first off, the book, as you mentioned, can be found at most bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Target, Goodreads, Amazon.com. You can order directly through ArcadiaPublishing.com/HistoryPress.com. So that's where you can find the book as well. And I'm also offering to speak to a little of my background. I've done quite a bit covering both the New York Jets, New Jersey Nets at the time, Brooklyn Nets for Fox Sports and Scout.com. I've done some New York Mets coverage for 247 Sports and New York Jets coverage as well. And like I said, the background that I have is in electronic journalism, so writing online. But really how I felt was the inspiration for the book, partly too, was in today's clickbait day and age where you spend so much time on an article and then maybe it has a shelf life of an hour, half hour, breaking news, great, I got 10,000 clicks, whatever the number is, that's it. This, I wanted to be like a lasting piece of evergreen content that Net fans that were aged 2 to 102, they maybe don't have an internet connection or they want to read it on their tablet as an ebook. I felt like this was a more substantial project that was going to stand the test of time instead of pumping out all these electronic articles constantly. So don't get me wrong, digital journalism is the wave of the future, and it's obviously how we are all getting our news on smartphones and other devices.
Right.
But there's still, I feel like, is a place for sports, particularly sports history books, because I feel like a lot of the history of these teams and these franchises and these players is getting lost in the clickbait society that we've created.
It really is. And, you know, it's nice to have this. It's kind of like a nice momentum. Right, to say, hey, you just pick this up, you look at it, it's got some great pictures. And obviously Arcadia's, they're responsible for a lot of those great New Jersey history books that you see, the Somerset County, and they have all these great pictures, history pictures. That's what they did here. It's a lot of great pictures, and of course Rick's research in here, which is very, very vast. This is going to be a good read. So obviously the holidays are coming. Obviously the NBA season is here. So for people who want to pick this up, well, this is something that I think would be a great gift for a lot of people.
And definitely, you can go. I maintain Nets coverage right now. That's at netsinsider.com. It's syndicated on Bleacher Report and Yardbarker. And if you want, I am offering autographed signed copies. You can send me an email if you go to netsinsider.com. All the information is there. Happy to send it out. And like Michael said, it's a good memento as a Nets fan, but also it's a lot of New Jersey history, a lot of New York history in there. And I'm sure somebody knows other. I know they say there's not a lot of Nets fans out there, but you'll be surprised when the team starts winning, they'll start coming out of the woodwork. So hopefully. Hopefully that's the case this season.
Folks, I want to thank you all for tuning in and listening here to Fox Sports On the Road. I'm again your host, Michael Cohen. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.